Hello, lovely listeners. Welcome back to another episode of Coffee and Crime, a true crime podcast. My name is Lisa Marie Imray, and if it's your first time tuning in, hi, how you doing? Each week, I sit down with a cup of coffee, and I talk to you all about a true crime story. Hello, YouTube. This is the second episode featuring on the YouTube, and I just want to say a little quick thank you to everyone who commented, liked, and shared last week's video. That's really helpful, but you're also like little tips and tricks that you threw my way have been really helpful, and hopefully as I continue with this, I'll get better. That's the goal, right? To get better at doing this. But I just have also noticed from watching other people on YouTube that you have to kind of do the cringy please like, rate, subscribe, share, do the all the things that you do down below. But that's also goes for you listening on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, iHeartRadio, and wherever you find Coffee and Crime. Please, if you could give this episode or the page itself a like, a review, a share, that would be super helpful. And I think that it's awesome just seeing the analytics of where Coffee and Crime is and how it's going. Yes, I am all blocked up and super nasally today. I do apologize because that's going to be gross, but I have COVID at the moment. Well, I tested negative yesterday, but I tested positive at the start of the week. So I have been battling COVID this week and it's not been fun, but we are here and it's not going to stop us. No, the show must go on, as they say in the theatre. But because I have not been feeling myself, I'm not drinking coffee today. In fact, I'm having a green tea and I'm nearly at the end of it now. But it's like nature's natural energy drink. So that's what I'm having today. Sorry, little disclaimer. Green tea and crime just doesn't have the same ring. But this week, so we are going to go a long way back in time and have a chat about the oldest active missing persons case in United States history. Oldest, that's pretty self-explanatory, happened a long time ago. Active, people are still investigating this missing persons case today. And we'll talk about that and we'll get into that a little bit later on. But that's just wild. It's wild. And this case is actually quite different for Coffee and Crime to cover because there's been no ruling on what happened to this person. So we don't even know if a crime has been committed. So it might not actually fall under the true crime genre. But the mystery that shrouds this case is just so interesting and it's baffling. And I wanted to do a quick little run over the facts that we know, because we don't know a lot. We know some things, but it's also about getting awareness out that this case is still active. And I think it's important for people to know that they could contribute in a way, finding, you know, like your DNA profile that can help in missing persons cases. You never know, but that's what we are here to talk about today. So, lovely listeners of Coffee and Crime, grab your cup of coffee, your green tea, or whatever caffeinated beverage you need to get through your day, and join me as I tell you about the mysterious disappearance of Marvin Alvin Clark. Warning. The following episode contains adult language, discussion on suicide and murder that listeners may find disturbing. This podcast is intended for listeners 16 years and above. Listener discretion is advised. Now, with being one of the oldest missing persons cases, the details of the story are somewhat disjointed and we have like little pieces of basic information, but not much to kind of make a full story or give a full picture. But we're going to work with what we've got. So we are going to step into the world of the 1850s to get us started. So grab your bow tie, your sonic screwdriver, step into the TARDIS, and let's go through the time vortex. Probably should get some cool sound effects on that or something. But I'm not that clever, but I am a huge Doctor Who fan, so there you go. Let us start by meeting our main character for today's story, who is Marvin Alvin Clark. He was born in or around the year of 1852, according to the US Census, and he was born in Marion County in Iowa. Now, even though he's from Iowa, his parents, Miranda and George Clark, hailed from New York. They were New Yorkians. New Yorkans. No, what is it? New Yorkers. They were New. I'm working here. They were those people. Sorry. Don't cancel me, New York. That's literally the first thing that comes to mind when I think of New York. But that's originally where they're from. We know that Marvin was well educated, as he has graduated from 2 different universities in his lifetime. Now, this is what gets me. Okay, little rant here. This is what gets me about, like, these older cases, because we get little snippets, and this is what I mean. It's reported later on, and we'll get to it, that he graduated from 2 different universities, but nowhere in any report, in any document, in any video that I watched in regards to this case, did it say what universities they were. And I get it that documenting things is not the same, and keeping documents, there was no cloud to send things up into, and there was fires and natural disasters which so conveniently happened to destroy a lot of record-keeping places, but it's like, did no one think to maybe put it down in multiple places? Do you have his certificates? What's the stamp at the top of the certificate? Was it University of Iowa? What did he study? Because that is something that's going to come into play a little bit later on. It would just be nice for one full piece of information, but we don't have that. So, Lisa Marie, get over yourself. Let's move on. Pretty much, that's the basic information. In 1852, he was born. Nice. In the years that followed, at some point, he graduated from 2 different unknown universities. Nice. At some point, he got married to a woman named Mary. Nice. He had 4 children. Nice. And then in 1910, according to the US Census, he was living in Tigard in Oregon. Nice. That's super basic. And it's, again, snippets of information that we just don't have. Like, at one point in Marvin and Mary's marriage, they were living in Nebraska. And again, this is by the US Census. So if we went from Iowa to Nebraska, that's a 6.5-hour drive. But then if they're at one point in Nebraska and then the next point they're in Tigard, Oregon, that's 22.5-hour drive. And can I just say, those are the times it would take today to drive. Okay? Today. Can you imagine how long it would have taken back in the 1910s, early 1900s to do a 22.5-hour drive? It would take days. Days. Geography is the one thing that absolutely blows my mind. We also know that Marvin was a marshal in Nebraska and in Linton in Oregon. And Linton is now a part of Portland, which is in like the northwest of Oregon State. And Marshall, he was a retired sheriff, pretty much. A marshal could be like a fire marshal, like a park ranger, a town marshal. But if reports didn't say he was a marshal, it said that he was a retired sheriff. So he was in law enforcement, which makes me go to think, well, what did he study at university? I think that would have been really fascinating. And especially if he graduated from 2 different universities, was he doing some sort of like law degree? Was there criminology back then? Because if so, Marvin, my man. I also am a criminology graduate, so up top. Woo. And can I just say, Marvin fits like the stereotypical olden day sheriff look, okay? Think olden day sheriff. He had a fabulously full mustache, and like, I mean, it hugged all round his top lip, and it was full, and it was white, and it was just, you know when you look at a picture of like a person in advanced stages of life, elderly people, and you look at them and you go, I bet you were real good looking in your prime days. Well, that is what I get from pictures of Marvin. Now, I mean, you might have Googled it already, you might have seen it on Instagram, you might have seen it through this video, a picture of Marvin, but he aged like fine wine, a good cheese, like Gouda. Is that a good cheese? Good Gouda. He just looked super classy, vintage almost, just, in my opinion, this is just my opinion. My opinion, he was a very dapper, well-dressed gentleman. He also carried a cane, if you want to add that to your mental image of a well-dressed, fine man, because that's what I thought he was. So, anyway, Move on, Lee Spring, move on. But in the mid-1920s, Marvin is in his early to mid-70s, because we don't know his exact birth date. It's like give or take on his age at different points. But he's living in Tigard in Oregon, and he is a farmer. So he's retired as being a sheriff, and he's gone to be a farmer. And I've seen a picture of his house, which I will also post up, and it didn't look like it had heaps of land, so I'm wondering if he was just an avid gardener. You know what I mean? I feel like he just probably had his own really good veggie patch, and he just liked pulling up his turnips. I don't know if he had any kind of animals, or, I mean, he might have had some chickens. We don't know, but from the picture of the house, it didn't look like it had a lot of land. It might have done, I could be completely wrong, but I just like to imagine Mr. Clark and pulling up his turnips and his beetroots and being so proud at the size of his carrots. He just looks like that kind of person. He'd be like, Mary, come look at my carrots. And they'd be like, brr, that's a prize-winning pumpkin there, Mary. Take it down to the state fair. Oh my gosh, stop. At this point in the mid-1920s, Marvin's four children have all grown up. They are all of adult age. But we only know, and we're only going to talk about two of them because they're involved in today's case and today's story. And I'm not 100% sure about what happened to the other two. So we'll just roll with what we've got. It's what we do here. We just roll with what we've got. So what happened to Marvin? Well, on October 30th, 1926, Halloween Eve, if you want to add another mysterious component to the story, it has nothing to do with it, but let's just go with it. Marvin leaves his home in Tigard around 1 p.m. in the afternoon and is set off for Portland, which is about 10 miles or 16 kilometers down the road. Today, it'd be about a 10-15 minute drive. It is a hop, skip, and a jump down the street, basically. It does take a little bit longer back in the 1920s, so let's say it's maybe a 45-minute drive. I don't know. I do not know. I do not know how long it took, but it took a little bit longer. So why is Marvin going down to Portland? Well, that, my lovely listeners, is mystery number one. There is no definitive answer as to why Marvin has gone down to Portland. It seems that Mary, Marvin's wife, believed that her husband was going to Portland to visit their daughter, Sydney McDougall, who was the manager of the Hereford Hotel at 735 Hoyt Street in Northwest Portland. So Mary thought that that's where Marvin was going. Others speculate that Marvin was going to Portland to see his doctor. You see, I said that Marvin carried a cane, and that wasn't a fashion choice. He had to, because unfortunately he had some health problems which caused him to suffer from partial paralysis on his right side. He had like barely any mobility in his right hand, and his right foot dragged behind him when he walked, and he was said to, quote, have a halting gait, end quote, when he walked. So that's a very plausible reason to also be going to Portland. However, a day or two after departing from Tigard, Mary got in contact with Sydney and said, where's your father? Is he with you? And Sydney was like, no, I didn't know he was coming. There had been no communication between Marvin and Sydney about him going to Portland to see her. And he obviously didn't tell Mary where he was going. So they're all just a little bit confused about where Marvin is at this point. It is possible that Marvin went to his doctor without telling anyone where he's going. It's a very private matter going to see your doctor, and back in those days people are very proud. He probably didn't want his family knowing if he was needing to see a doctor for any reason. Who knows? But it's, you know, it's likely that if he went there and he didn't leave until 1 p.m. in the afternoon, he might not have wanted to take the journey back, so was going to stop into Sydney's hotel, the Hereford Hotel. But these are just theories. Nobody knows what happened to Marvin, and it's just trying to make sense. Because that's what we need to do as humans. We need to make things make sense. And this case, nothing does. Anyway, when Mary realized that Marvin wasn't with Sydney, she immediately got in contact with local law enforcement, who in turn initiated a search instantly. They were really quick about it and really onto it. Marvin was a well-known resident in the area and by most accounts was well-liked. They put ads in local papers such as the Oregonian, which we will talk about quite a bit, about his disappearance, and they also alerted all the northwestern cities in the Oregon state to be on the lookout for a white Caucasian male, early to mid-70s, with white hair, a white mustache, blue eyes, wearing a dark suit. Mary did let law enforcement know as well that Marvin's coat was at home, which is quite odd because in October, November time in the US, it's mid to late fall, autumn season, it's getting into winter, it's cold, and he left without his coat. It's odd. Law enforcement also let people on the lookout for him know that he wore wire-rimmed glasses and leather high-top boots. But the most important detail, the key piece of descriptive detail that police gave, was that he carried a cane, walked with a limp, and his right foot dragged behind him. Like, that piece of information right there was vital. And you would notice that, and you would remember if you saw someone. Not so much the dark suit, or maybe a nice hat, or the boots, because that might have been the fashion trend at the time. But the fact that his right foot dragged behind them when he walked was... that's what police and that's what family were hoping for a tip to come in about the whereabouts of Marvin. On November 9th, about a week and a half after Marvin left Tigard, Grover C. Clark, who was Marvin's son, who also lived in Portland, not far away from Sydney, he received a letter on November 9th. This letter was allegedly from his father, Marvin. It was signed off at the bottom as Marvin. However, this letter was postmarked from Bellingham, Washington, over 4 hours away in today's time. That's probably like a 2-day journey back in the 1920s. So why the heck is he sending a letter from there? But he received a letter, and this is great news, right? There's been some sort of communication. He's alive. He has sent a letter. However, the bad news about this is that his handwriting was completely illegible, did not make any kind of sense, and was all jumbled up. Picture a doctor's note for your prescription meds. It was worse than that, okay? It was just a scribble. And this is how we actually know that Marvin graduated from two different universities, because the Oregonian, the newspaper, they reported about the letter that was received, and they wrote, quote, "The letter indicated the aged man's mind is wandering as it was badly jumbled, despite the fact that Clark is highly educated, being a graduate of two universities," end quote. So that's how that little piece of information got started. Too bad they didn't say which ones. I'm still not mad about that. Anyway, this is great news. Grover and his wife, they immediately went up to Bellingham, Washington as soon as they got the letter and realized who it was from. But unfortunately, they could not locate Marvin anywhere. They did ask around town, and some witnesses claimed to have seen a man in a dark suit around two hotel areas on November 2nd and November 3rd, only a couple of days after he left his home in Tigard. And this then brings back, maybe he was going to Sydney's hotel and maybe he got confused, but how the hell did he end up in Bellingham, Washington, over 4 hours away from Tigard in Oregon? That's another mystery. But unfortunately, by the time that Grover and his wife received the letter, you know, it was about a week after his last sightings, they get to Bellingham, there is just no trace of Marvin. There are no leads, or any leads go nowhere, and Marvin is not seen or heard from again. On November 11th, Sydney, Marvin's daughter, she granted a $100 reward for any definite information concerning the whereabouts of her father, Marvin. This was a substantial amount for 1926. If I was to do the inflation and the conversion and all that, $100 in 1926 would be $1,676 US today, which converted over to New Zealand dollars would be 2,616. So a pretty hefty amount. And I thought it'd be quite interesting, but what I was trying to do was find out how much it would cost to stay one night in a hotel back in 1926, just to kind of do some quick math on, you know, how many people would have to stay one night at the Hereford Hotel to get up to $100. It was so hard, and I couldn't find it because I was searching, you know, like 1926 hotels pricing, and there is literally a hotel called 1926 Hotel, so literally everything was just all about that hotel, and I gave up. Sorry. But unfortunately, even with this reward, there was no leads, there was no nothing. Marvin quite literally disappeared off the face of the earth. So there is some cause to speculate that perhaps Marvin was not in a fit mental state. The fact that he didn't communicate with anyone where he was going, we don't know if that was like normal for him or not. We don't know if he was a very secretive man. We don't know what was normal for him. You'd think maybe Mary had would have a diary with it written down if he had a doctor's appointment. There didn't seem to be any of that kind of stuff. So there's that. He left his coat at home on a very cold day. He sent a letter that was illegible. It was all jumbled up, even though he was highly educated. Maybe he just wasn't okay. Maybe he wasn't well. His family feared one of two things might have happened to Marvin. One being that he might have had an accident, you know, with his paralysis, with his advanced age and his declining mental capacity. It is not unrealistic that he might have got confused, he might have got lost, and that's how he ended up in Bellingham, Washington. If that letter did in fact come from him, we obviously do not know. It just was signed off Marvin, so that's all we can really go on. And maybe he had an accident, he didn't know where he was, he fell, he slipped, and it wasn't all a complete accident. The other theory that his family feared was that the fact that he used to be a marshal in Portland, you know, in Lynnet, in the town of Lynnet, which is now in Portland, he might have had some enemies around the place, and perhaps foul play was involved, and his family feared that he had been murdered, essentially, by being the marshal. He might have run into an old bad guy that he round up one time or another. Unfortunately, there is just no evidence of any suspicious activity. There's no crime scene anywhere. There's just nothing to go on. No one knows what happened to Marvin Alvin Clark, and his case went cold for a long time. We're going to fast forward now to 1986, 60 years later, 60 years after he went missing. There were some loggers working near Scopose in Oregon, which is a little bit north of Portland, and they came across some skeletal remains, called it in, and when law enforcement was searching around the surrounding areas, they found a 1888 V nickel, a 1919 penny, a pocket watch, leather shoes, wire-rimmed glasses, a Fraternal Order of Eagles pocket knife, and four tokens with D and P inscribed on them, and a .32 caliber revolver that was quite corroded, meaning it had been there for some time. Just quickly, because I thought this was super interesting, the Fraternal Order of Eagles, which is probably the most American name you could give a club, like Fraternals Order Eagle. I don't know what that eagle was. It's a pretty pathetic eagle. But like, how American is that name? They are an international non-profit uniting fraternally in the spirit of liberty, truth, justice, and equality to make human life more desirable by lessening its ills and promoting peace, prosperity, gladness, and hope. Like, how cute is that? This is a big club that does a lot of good things. Essentially, some of their major accomplishments including founding Mother's Day. They founded Mother's Day. Like, that, I suppose that had to come from somewhere, but I've just never really, like, thought about it. But apparently the Fraternal Order of Eagles were the ones who founded Mother's Day as, like, an actual, like, thing. Every day should be Mother's Day, if you ask me, but hey, that's just my opinion. I don't want to bring for some bed every day, of course not. I don't want my children to be nice to me. My child, I only have one. They also created a research center for diabetes at the University of Iowa. They were a driving force behind Social Security. They ended age-based job discrimination and lots more things. Like, their list of accomplishments is very impressive. And they had some pretty noteworthy members as well, such as Theodore Franklin and Eleanor Roosevelt, Warren Harding, Harry and Bess Truman, JFK, and Ronald Reagan, just to name a few of the former United States presidents and first ladies. They had Bob Hope, who's a comedian, and Billy Ray Cyrus. We're all members. Like, you'd think this thing was like a cult or something, like with this super wide mixed range of all this, like all these people. Anyway, I just thought that was a few little fun facts about the FOE of America. The foe of America. No, but seriously, they sound like a very hardworking group of people. But that was inscripted on a pocket knife that was found near these skeletal remains. Now, we don't know if Marvin was a part of these group of people. So all this stuff was found not too far away from Portland. Some very convincing artifacts with the body that, because they even brought like historians in to see, well, what era are these things from and give more information about the pieces. And they said that, yeah, no, it's very plausible that someone in the early 1900s would be carrying this kind of stuff. The bones themselves, because of medical examiners and medical technology, they were deduced to have been sitting there for roughly about 60 odd years, meaning that the person died within the 1920s. Things are adding up here to be Marvin, right? This discovery was obviously published in all of the newspapers around the place, including the Oregonian, and a mere few days later, a woman by the name of Dorothy Willoughby comes into the local police station of the county or the town or, you know, the police station that was looking after this little case that had arisen, claiming that the body may have belonged to her grandfather, Marvin Alvin Clark. So Dorothy Willoughby is the granddaughter of Marvin Alvin Clark. And I mean, everything was there, right? The location was plausible. The artifacts were plausible. The pieces of clothing, especially the leather shoes and the wire-rimmed glasses. It wasn't a far-off shot that this actually could have been him. The medical examiner of the skeletal remains said that the person who the skeletons belonged to had a bullet hole in their skull, and obviously with the revolver being found close by, ballistics matching up, the death was ruled as a suicide. Now, Dorothy told investigators that based from other family members and what they had said, Marvin had become quite reclused and somewhat depressed in his last few years because of his health problems, because of his paralysis and his mental capacity. So Marvin leaving town without telling anyone to take his own life, writing a letter back to his son, which possibly could have been a goodbye, it's not an impossible theory. The only thing that medical experts doubted that it was Marvin was that the bones seemed to belong to a much younger person, someone likely between the ages of 35 to 55, whereas Marvin was in his early to mid 70s, so that didn't quite match up. But Dorothy wanted to hold on to the fact that this family mystery might be coming to an end, and she wanted to know. However, the lack of DNA testing technology, they were unable to get a match or progress further on any identification, so the skeleton became a John Doe with the very possible likelihood that it was Marvin. However, they just couldn't say with 100%, what's the word I'm looking for? They just couldn't say for sure if it was actually Marvin or not. Dorothy Willoughby died 5 years later in 1991, and once again, the case went cold. Fast forward to 2004. Dr. Nikki Vance became a forensic anthropologist at the Oregon State Medical Office, and she started sifting through the office's unidentified remains, closed cases or cold case, or not closed cases, sorry, cold cases, unsolved mysteries. She's going through all them. And it wasn't until 2011, so a very long time after that, that she came across Marvin Alvin Clark and John Doe's file. And they're both from 1986. Well, that was the last update of Marvin, but believed that both of them had died or, you know, something happened to them in the mid-1920s. And she realized that the remains of John Doe, she still had in storage. So she got, like, excited, because that would be exciting, because you're a step closer to figuring something out. She was able to send off a sample to the Center for Human Identification at the University of North Texas. And they were able to get a full DNA profile after like 85 years of this like body being there, or you know, John Doe's death. They were able to get a full DNA profile. Like, that body, that those bones have been sitting there out in the wilderness, exposed for about 60 years before they were found, exposed to the elements, to animals, and then they were picked up and they were moved around and they were stored into a box, and they were still able to get a full DNA profile. Like, bodies are amazing. Like, that's insane. And I love that kind of stuff. I love forensics so much. It's just so fascinating. But now they needed to find someone with Marvin's DNA. So the hunt for the descendants began. They had to find someone that they could start matching pieces of the DNA up to. And in 2014, Pam Knowles appears. And she is the great-great-granddaughter of Marvin Alvin Clark. She gave a swab, she gave an interview at least, and she sent it off to the lab. But the issue with this is that it would only show like a part, just one single part of the DNA profile. And to get a positive match, they're going to need more parts of the puzzle, essentially, from the maternal side, the paternal side, his direct descendants, as many relatives, in order to get a full picture. Anyway, they worked with what they had. They sent Pam's DNA off and John Doe's DNA off, and it took about 6 months for the results to come back, only to find out it was not a match. Our John Doe was not Marvin. So we started off with one mystery, and now we are left with two. Who is this John Doe who presumably took his own life in the woods? And then what happened to Marvin? We just don't know. Where did he go? Where is he resting now? Why did he leave? Why? What was going through his mind? Obviously, this is something we'd never know, but what was going through his mind to the point that he decided to leave? He didn't say anything to anyone. Was it a declining mental state? Or did he just want to leave on his own accord because he wanted to take his own life and he wanted to do that away from his family? Like, and that's really sad. That's really sad. So law enforcement are now hoping that maybe a hunter, a developer, a landscaper, someone will come across the bones of Marvin, be able to send them in. And because they've got Pam's DNA on file, if any bones found were Marvin's, they would be able to get a positive match. But for now, genealogists are looking to find more relatives and more descendants to strengthen the DNA profile that they have on records, just to be absolutely sure, so that they could finally put this very old missing persons case to rest, really, and be able to send Marvin back home to his family so that they could bury him properly, because at the moment we don't know where he's buried, we don't know what's happened to him, we don't know where his bones are lying. So, with that lovely thought, that, my lovely listeners, is the mysterious disappearance of Marvin Alvin Clark. Obviously, if there are any updates at all, I will be posting them, but who can say, really? It's going to be, like I said, someone coming upon them by chance, you know, which is a shame, but there are so many unanswered questions. Like I said, why did he leave? Did he really end up in Bellingham, Washington, in a completely different state? How did he get there? Was it because he was confused? Was it because he wanted to go? Or did he, you know what? Maybe he just left. Maybe he just decided that he had had enough of his life, and he actually just left and lived the rest of his days on a beach somewhere. And that, my lovely listeners, is the mysterious disappearance of Marvin Alvin Clark, and also a little bit of a snippet about the mysterious suicide of a John Doe, who we may never know who that is. Obviously, if there are any updates, I will be posting them because that would be a huge breakthrough in this case, especially with it being the oldest active case in United States history. But all we can hope for now is for more people, you know, if you have relatives in Oregon or Iowa or New York, if you have any kind of inkling that you may be related to Marvin or maybe a cousin of Marvin or anyone that could be related to Marvin Alvin Clark, that do one of those ancestry things, get your DNA on file. Obviously, if you want, it's your DNA. You don't need to put it anywhere, really. But that's kind of what genealogists are hoping for. Marvin has been missing for 96 years, 2 months, and 19 days. And I just want to say that, Marvin, wherever you are, buddy, that I hope that whatever happened to you was quick and painless, and that you didn't suffer in any kind of way, and that you are at peace now. So here's to you, Marvin, you beautiful mustached man. I hope that you're doing good wherever you are. Cheers. As always, lovely listeners, if you'd like to get in touch with me with your thoughts and feelings or your theories about this case, because I'd love to hear what you guys think, the best way to get in contact with me is on Instagram or Facebook at Coffee and Crime Podcast. You can even leave comments on this video and I will reply to it. You can also head over to redbubble.com and search Coffee and Crime Pod, and you can view our merch store. I have got a few things coming over, so I can't wait to show you guys all of that. But yeah, that's all from me. Thanks for coming. Thanks for being here. I hope you have a wonderful rest of your week. Have a great weekend. And until next time, be safe, be good, be better, and all that cheesy crap. And I will catch you guys next week for another episode of Coffee and Crime. Bye!